listening to the Transform Your Nutrition Podcast with your hosts, Rebecca Heald and Jeff Ash. Our purpose is to help individuals and families transform their relationships with food and develop healthy bodies, minds, and attitudes, all without restriction, guilt, or shame. All right. Well, we are here for another episode, and we're really excited to have with us a very, very special guest today, Morgan Skatz, who is a registered dietitian nutritionist. And so we are excited to have you today.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here.
Yes. So I have power back this week now after the Texas snowpocalypse, I guess is what a lot of us have been calling it this week. And so we recorded a podcast episode just a couple of days ago with another guest, and I was in a very large a grand ballroom at a hotel with chandeliers and lighting and exposed brick and a loud echo. So I'm glad to be back at my little home studio here. But as we get started here, we would love for you to just kind of introduce yourself, tell us about yourself, and in particular, and your work and everything. And in particular, we'd love to hear your story about how you got interested in fitness and nutrition, and maybe the journey that you've gone through, because I know in reading over your posts that you have definitely had a transition in the way you've thought from the time that you got into this whole thing.
Yeah, wow. So I'll try and condense this as much as I can. Mm-hmm. I am a registered dietitian, a licensed dietitian in the state of Pennsylvania. Currently, I work at WIC, so Women, Infant, Children, which is a program for low-income women and children. We provide nutrition services for them. And then I also work at a private practice in my area called Mid-Atlantic Nutrition Specialist, where you have the opportunity to work one-on-one with families and adults. Wow, my story. So I originally got into nutrition, I think, because I was mainly just interested in how food affected our body. Mm-hmm. But it's evolved so much over the years. At that time, I was very immersed in diet culture. I believed that weight loss was good. Of course, like this, so many people, this is how their stories started, right? Yeah. I thought that very large bodies were unhealthy and all that crappy stuff I believed in. Because of my beliefs, I went on my own weight loss journey, and I did lose weight. And my weight loss led to a lot of compliments, which felt really good. So I continued on that weight loss journey, and I restricted even more and more, and got to a very small body and ended up with a full-blown eating disorder. Through there, I went through nutrition counseling. And at this time, I was in my undergrad. I went through nutrition counseling. I went through therapy. And I was able to almost fully recover, I would say. I thought I was fully recovered. I believe they call it, is it pseudo-recovery?
Yes.
I believe.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, thank you. I was eating a lot more foods. And I definitely, in my head, wasn't restricting as much, but I still had underlying rules that I thought I had to follow in order to not let my body get too large. And throughout all this time, I never recovered my menstrual cycle that I lost at the beginning of my eating disorder. And the doctors and nutritionists that I were working with and dietitians that I was working with were just totally stumped. They ran blood tests on me, ultrasounds, and they just kept saying, you know, you're in a quote unquote healthy body. My gynecologist said I didn't work out like an Olympic athlete. So meanwhile, she never actually asked me how much I was working out. And it was quite a bit. So they did test, ultrasounds, sent me to specialists, and they were stumped. And then finally, one day, I just went to my primary care physician for another issue. And I told her about my menstrual cycle. And she was basically said, why don't you try working out less and eating more? And of course, those kind of thoughts had been whispered to me over the years. But I was like, no, my doctors are telling me I'm fine. So that must not be the issue. But when she said it, I went home and I did a Google search and I found hypothalamic amenorrhea, which is basically the loss of your menstrual cycle due to stress on your body, whether it's under eating, over exercising, work, stress from work, other things. And my mind was just blown that the fact that I could be very physically fit in a, again, quote unquote, healthy body weight, but my body was not healthy. And I, like, that hadn't even crossed my mind. I was just, my mind was so blown. And from there, I read the book, No Period, Now What? Learned about how I needed to increase my BMI and eat a ton more calories in order to regain my cycle. That led me to the book Health at Every Size and Intuitive Eating. And it was just totally a rabbit trail from there. And I, once you start learning about it, it's hard to unsee it. And I was hooked, and I totally shifted who I was following on social media, and all this time I'm still in my undergrad. I shifted who I was, what podcast I was listening to. I asked different questions in class, and I couldn't look back. And I'm very thankful that I went through that journey so early on, because now as a dietitian, I'll never even practice weight loss, even though I probably or definitely gave some not good advice when I was still in my undergrad to people that would ask me. I feel fortunate that I'm not doing that in my career now.
Wow, what a fantastic story. I think Rebecca can relate to a lot of that herself, not to speak for her, but I know she shared this in the past on the podcast. And
yeah, and the whole story, like you said, about. So can I just ask you, just interestingly, obviously you said something very similar happened to me. I lost my menstrual cycle at the very beginning of my eating disorder. And I only recently, over the last couple of years, actually got my menstrual cycle back. What really blew my mind, Morgan, was that I actually had two children whilst barely having, I had an odd period over the years, an odd one here or there, but never regularly, never like now, I'm, like clockwork. So there were even times when my weight was, my BMI was actually quite healthy, but I still wasn't having periods. And I fully believe it was because still, like you, I also believed I'd recovered, but hadn't, because psychologically I was still restricting. Psychologically, I was still trying to manage my weight through what I ate. So I don't think it was until I was able to let go of that actually, my body did, got back to where it needed to be and to what it needed to do. So one thing I wanted to ask is, you mentioned about, obviously you felt or everyone told you you were in a healthy body, but it wasn't until you actually, was it not until your BMI actually increased that your periods came back? Is that right?
Yeah, that's a great question. I also feel like I should, maybe you guys have already done this before, but I feel like I should clarify that hypothalamic amenorrhea doesn't only present in smaller bodies. It can show up in larger bodies too, which is a huge misconception. I just feel like I wasn't totally clear on that. But according to No Period, Now What, which is like the Bible of hypothalamic amenorrhea.
Read
it. It was written by Nicola Rinaldi, and she's an expert in the field. But through her research, she has found that a BMI of 23 to 24 is optimal for fertility. And of course, we always take BMI with a grain of salt, but that's what the research has shown, a minimum BMI of 23 and 24. And when I first started the journey, I wasn't weighing myself at the time. And so I was like, oh, yeah, I'm definitely there. There's no question. And then when I did actually weigh myself and calculate my BMI, because that's at this point was not a triggering act for me, so it was safe for me to do, it was not at that number. And I again calculated how many pounds I would need to gain to get to that number. And I overshot that number, which is totally fine. So yeah, my BMI did have to increase. If you're okay with me using numbers, I gained about 30 pounds throughout that journey. And technically, according to my calculations, I only had to gain 10 pounds to get to that BMI and regain my fertility. But 10 pounds apparently wasn't enough for my body. It needed 30.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a really good point. You know, when I was reading through one of your recent blog posts, it was a fantastic one. I think it was from November of 2020. And you made these three really good points. And that brings up one of the points that you had mentioned, which was we can't assume anything by about someone's health by looking at them. And it's so easy for us to say, well, we see a person in that smaller body and we just assume that they are a healthier person. And then you look at someone else who is in a larger body and you assume that they aren't eating healthy. And it, I think that's so important that you just kind of highlighted that with what you described, that even when you were at that quote, healthy BMI and healthy weight for your height, that your body still needed something different.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And I mean, there's not one health condition that only shows up in larger body people or only shows up in very small body people. We really can't name one. I used to do sprint triathlons when I was in my pseudo recovery, and there was people in larger bodies, very large bodies, totally just crushing those triathlons, doing so awesome. And most people, if you saw them on the street, you would probably think, oh, they're unhealthy. They don't exercise. They don't take care of themselves. And meanwhile, they were probably beating me because I probably wasn't fueling myself properly at the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great point.
But this is, again, it's the society that we're living in, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Fat phobia. It is just everywhere. And we make judgments and we don't always do it consciously, do we? It's often an unconscious bias, but it's so ingrained, isn't it, within our culture, within, you know, where we look, everything that we're told. And I think that's the thing. And I have clients that come to me that have experienced this from, you know, through their GPs or, you know, not or through or just generally, where they've felt, you know, they've felt really, what's the word? Well, it's really, really, they felt ashamed. They felt ashamed because of the body that they're in, because they've been told that they need to lose weight in order to be healthy. But I've got some clients that are in bigger bodies that are, like you said, healthier than I could ever be. Mm-hmm. You know, they're more active. They're probably, you know, eating better than I do on occasions. And you know, yet they're, you know, society is still looking at them and kind of pigeonholing them. And it's just, yeah, it's not right, is it? But then, they'll often sit with me and they'll say, but my GP's telling me I'm unhealthy because of my BMI, Becky. You know, my, the person I'm supposed to trust the most is telling me this. So it's really, really hard for me to integrate what you're saying with what my GP is telling me.
Yeah. It's so hard.
Well, what would you say, you talked about in this same article, you pointed out something about health at every size and how it doesn't support intentional weight loss. And then you kind of mentioned that when you refer to intentional weight loss, you're referring to weight loss that's achieved by intentionally restricting calories or food groups. But then you said, but it understands weight loss might be a byproduct of pursuing healthy behaviors. And it also understands sometimes weight gain is a byproduct and sometimes weight maintenance is. So none of them are really right, wrong, or frowned upon or that goal. So I thought that was a really good point that you made there, that it's not that there's anything necessarily wrong with losing weight. It's that you're trying to find that place where your body functions best. And that's going to be different for each person. Because you also pointed out the set point theory that Rebecca and I have talked about on a number of occasions, because that's just, and what's interesting is that set point theory has been talked about a lot in the standard fitness community, in the standard weight loss community, as a way of explaining why it can be hard to lose weight. But yet, so it's talked about in both the non-diet world and that fitness world. So maybe you can talk a little bit about weight loss and how that works into how you work with people.
Yeah. So people do come to me initially, you know, wanting weight loss, mm-hmm. of course, makes sense in our culture, in our society. And the first thing I'll do is I'll talk to them a little bit, try and gain as much information as to why they are pursuing weight loss, what their main goals are, et cetera. And then I will come to a point where I will explain at the practice I work at and how I do my work. We do intuitive eating. We don't do intentional weight loss. And usually it comes down to, you mentioned you want to feel less sluggish, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Like, can we pursue that outside of weight loss? And of course the client can always say, you know, I really just want to lose weight. And that's their choice and that's fine. And at that time I would refer them out to somebody else. But if a client says, yeah, we can work on my behaviors and my feelings outside on weight loss, even if it's just putting weight loss on the back burner for now, because usually when we can do that, then by the time that they work through everything else, they're ready to revisit what weight really means to them.
Do you find,
yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, no, that's really, yeah, I love that. Cause I do the same with my clients, you know, what does weight loss mean to you? And one of the things I often say is, I could wave a magic wand and you could feel, I mean, I had even a conversation with with a client before, that, you know, they believe that when they lose the weight, they're going to be more confident. They're going to love themselves. If I could wave that magic wand and help you to feel like that right now in the body that you're in right now, how would that feel? And that's always a really good question, because they're always like, well, if I could feel the way that I want to feel without losing weight right now, then yeah, that would be amazing. So that's kind of often, you know, because I say, so let's pursue that. And the weight loss, like you say, it kind of becomes secondary. And if it happens, it happens from a different place, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
And often I find that clients still have that, even when they do start working with me, they still have that, like you say, but often as well, some of the clients that I work with, it becomes, their goals change as well over the time of, you know, throughout the process.
Yeah, exactly. And the first thing that I usually do, or one of the first things, is say, can we put the scale away? Mm-hmm. Because weighing yourself will not be helpful at all during this process.
Yeah,
that's such a great point, because we get fixated on that scale. And I probably have that conversation with, well, I can't think of a client who I haven't had the scale conversation with that says, you know what, let's not jump on the scale every morning anymore. Let's not even weigh once a week anymore. Let's focus on the behaviors. And often what happens is that, you know, I've had that question before where they said, I'm thinking I might jump on the scale tomorrow. What do you think? And I say, well, how is that going to change what we've talked about, what we've discussed as far as the behaviors and the habits that, mm-hmm. that we said, you know, that you basically have said, yeah, I think I need to work on this. So I'm going to make that goal this week to work on this particular habit or behavior. I'm going to work on the structure of my eating. I'm going to try and sit down and be more mindful of what I'm doing and how I'm eating and those kinds of things. And then I said, so if the scale says that you're up or down, is that going to change what you're doing? And they said, well, no, I guess not. So it really helps. I think it really is such a powerful way of thinking about it, rethinking about it, because if you're doing what's healthy for your body, if you're being physically active and you're following a good kind of a structure in the way that you're setting up your meals throughout the day so that you're being more in tune with your eating, is, you know, what are you going to do different? Are you going to just say, oh, well, I'm in this, just restrict myself heavily? Now, is that good for you? We've kind of worked through that process and you've realized that that's not something that you enjoy. Do you experience that same kind of a thing when you're working with clients that maybe initially came to you for weight loss?
Yeah. And I always explain it in a way like, no matter what you do during the week, you can eat the exact amount of calories that MyFitnessPal says, mm-hmm. and which is always way, way too low. And you can exercise so however much, you still don't know what the scale is going to say at the end of the week. Mm-hmm. And you have no control over that. So let's focus on things we actually do have control over, because the scale, it always leaves you frustrated, defeated, disappointed in yourself, when instead you could say, I ate when I was hungry today, and that's a great accomplishment. I made sure to eat a fruit with my breakfast today, and that's a great accomplishment. Those behaviors.
I stopped when I was full rather than kind of letting myself go beyond fullness, you know, over.
Yeah. And, yeah.
Yeah. That's, sorry.
Now, how do you apply this? How would you apply this in your work with children? Because, you know, some people, one of the things that I've frustratingly come across is not only is diet culture applied in, you know, it's so prevalent with adults, but I've even seen personal trainers and other nutrition coaches sort of just modify the approach that they take with adults and fat loss to kids. And so then they start talking about, how do I get my kids to eat more healthy? How do I get my kids to eat less? Because my kid is getting kind of chubby. And so I want to make sure that they don't get chubby like I was as a kid and end up where I am now, you know, those kinds of things. How do you approach kind of what you've talked about here in general with working with maybe children and the whole, maybe whole families also?
Yeah. And that's where I work with all age groups. My passion is mostly working with parents to raise up healthy eaters. And I'm so fortunate, especially at WIC, I have the opportunity to do that all day long. And that's my passion because every single definitely almost every client I've worked with, but even almost every person you just talk to that has a iffy relationship with food, it stems back to their parents, or their grandparents or aunts, uncles. It stems back to adults that were in their life growing up that kind of instilled these beliefs in them. And I don't blame those adults because they learned it from someone else or the culture around them. It makes sense. But my goal is to end that cycle and prevent disordered eating in the future. And that's where, and Jeff, you and I have talked a lot about this on social media, but that's where Ellen Satter's work really comes into play. So implementing the division of responsibility, which means the parents decide what food is served, when food is served, even where it's served. But then they let the kids listen to their own body and decide if they're even going to eat and how much they eat. And that might mean that your child eats half a waffle that day, they might eat four waffles that day, and you just empower them to trust their body. And a key part of this whole thing also is taking foods off the pedestal. So we stop using words like junk food, like treat food, or you know, like especially like junk food, bad foods, good foods, because that just sends messages that when I eat cookies, I am bad. When I eat cookies, they are junk and I'm doing something wrong. And when I eat broccoli, I'm good. If we can just, and then it makes you want to eat cookies more. And when you have them, you feel like you're doing something wrong. So you need to eat a lot of them because it's probably going to be the last time you're going to eat them in a while. And it just spirals. And so if we can start with kids at a young age of just saying, cookies is just another food. They provide energy to your body. We can eat them alongside our peanut butter and jelly and our apple slices, and our body is fueled and ready to go for the rest of the day. Then as they grow up into an adult, not only through the division of responsibility, do they know how to listen to their body, but they also know how to eat a few cookies if they want and stop whenever they want and not feel like that take that guilt road trip.
I love this. I mean, this is obviously I've got two young boys and, you know, I'm living this right now. And I have got a question actually, because it's something I get asked, but it's so funny you should say what you were saying then, because obviously I'm trying to instill these messages. It's easy with my youngest at the minute because my eldest, I probably wasn't as well informed, I guess, when he was younger, and now he's getting to an age where, yeah, maybe, I don't know, obviously, you know, the messaging is still quite strong and stuff, but with my youngest particularly, he said to me the other day, "Mummy, some people call foods junk foods." And I just went, "Oh, okay, darling." I said, and he said, "But Mummy," he says, "I know that all foods are good foods." I said this to Jeff as well the other day. He said to me the other day, he really likes Cocoa Pops. I don't know what you call them over there. Do you call Cocoa Pops Cocoa Pops? Chocolate cereal?
Yeah, the Cocoa Puffs, yeah. I think, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. And we didn't have any the other day. And he went, "Mom, why have we got no play food for breakfast?" You know, and when you're just hearing it coming back at you, you're like, because we call it play food or fun food.
Yeah.
And he said to me the other day as well, he says, "Mommy," he said, "why are you the only person who..." This was the worrying thing for me. He said to me, "Why are you the only person who doesn't call foods healthy or unhealthy?" He said, "Everybody else says, you know, and I was just, and I never, and I always get curious about it. And I said, well, why do you think that is, darling? Because he comes to the conclusions himself, because we've had these conversations about eating broccoli all day is not healthy, but, you know, eating any too much of one, any one food, you know, isn't, but it's about the bigger picture. And he's getting it, which is nice to see. But then I, if I do talk to friends about that or anything like that, they kind of look at me like I'm an alien. It's like, what? So how do I teach my children what's healthy and what's not healthy? What do you mean I can't call, you know, if my child says something is healthy, then yeah, I'll tell them it's healthy. And so, and it's really, really hard, because it's not like you can just say in one sentence, well, this is how you should do it. You know, so what would you do? What do you, or what do you say to parents when they can't quite grasp it? And they say, well, how do I explain whether a food is healthy or not to my children?
Yeah. And that's where I think it can even help to just get rid of the terms healthy and unhealthy.
That's
because, because they're so relative. Like, for somebody who is scared to death of bread, it would be healthy for them to eat bread and eat as much as they want in order to get over those fears.
Yeah. Working with a client with that on that one right now.
Oh, awesome. Awesome. And so a child who won't even look at broccoli, it would be helpful to work with him on broccoli and serve it more and work on increasing those exposures. Yes. Whereas somebody who with an eating disorder who is eating way too much fiber, we probably need to not eat very much broccoli right now. So it's
great point.
Yeah, it's all relative. And I lost my train of thought.
I completely agree. And I was stumped a little bit, not kind of stumped, but I was talking to somebody and she's got a 12-year-old daughter who she's a bit worried about at the minute. She's got obviously this daughter she thinks has got body image issues, and you know, she's overly concerned about what's healthy and what isn't healthy, and she keeps saying to her mum, when her mum's serving her food, she's saying, mum, is that healthy? And the mum's like, what, you know, how do I deal with that? And it's interesting, because I was like her 12-year-old is using those words in those terms, because it's what they're taught at school as well, isn't it? I mean, some of the things my kids have come home and said that they've heard at school, or what the teachers have said, you know, it upsets me. But I know that the teachers are doing it from, you know, like you said, it's not their fault. It's the way that it's the belief system that they've been brought up with, et cetera, et cetera. And they're not trained to teach nutrition education. They're just not.
Mm.
But it's like, how do you, so I don't know. I mean, this is a question for both of you, because when she said this to me, she said, how do I approach this? And I said, speak to her about what health actually means to her. What is healthy? Because that one meal in itself, you know, you can't, it's not healthy, it's not unhealthy, it's about the bigger picture. It's about, you know, so I would start by trying to explore what healthy means to your 12-year-old daughter. And rather than just fixating on the term, I don't know if that was the right approach to take, but
yeah.
I think it's really difficult when you're, you know, with the old, like I said, with Leo, it's easier. He's a little bit younger. He hasn't quite formed, but like I've got a 10-year-old and she's got a 12-year-old who already have learned these terms, this language, these concepts. The only thing I can think is to get curious and start to explore language and what it means. That's the approach I'm taking, but I don't know if that's the right approach, because it's just
that's what I was thinking, like asking questions. And you know, she's old enough where you can ask questions and you can look into some of the research with her and talk about what healthy means. Like, is it really healthy to not eat pizza with your friends because pizza isn't quote unquote healthy? No, the social aspect of that, that's the healthier part. And at the same time, there's absolutely nothing unhealthy about pizza. It's just another food. It has carbs, protein, fat. It tastes delicious. It has vitamins and minerals in it. I was literally talking through how there's not one food that doesn't benefit our body in one way. A candy bar is energy for our body. And where I was, I think I lost my train of thought before, where you were asking about with the parents asking about healthy versus unhealthy. I would also be curious how that worked out for them when they learned about unhealthy and healthy foods. Where are they now in their relationship with food? Can they eat whatever foods and not feel guilty about it? Can they eat whatever foods and not be thinking about what exercise they need to do and how many calories is in it and if they should or should not be eating that food?
People don't recognize, though, do they? People do not recognize. I did a webinar a few weeks ago, and I was speaking to somebody who watched it yesterday, and he said, if you'd have said to me 2 or 3 weeks ago, have I got a healthy relationship with food? Am I controlled by food? He said, I would have said yes and no, no food. He said, but since doing your webinar, he said, I've realized just how I am living my life by rules and how food is controlling me. So people don't see it, do they? And I had one client who said to me, you've basically told me that everything I thought was healthy is not. And it's, yeah, it's like counting calories or, you know, restricting. I had one lady yesterday who said that somebody had put her on a plan and she wasn't allowed to eat more than 5 grams of fat per meal. And, you know, and she thought that the believing that this is healthy. And yeah, so it blows their mind when, you know, when we kind of, you know, unpick that. But yeah, no, that's great. Sorry.
I love what you said there, Morgan, about the social aspect of it. Yeah. And whenever I've done any speaking on the topic and put together resources on this, I always start off with talking about what is health, because yeah. I think it's I think we take it for granted. I think people understand, you know, mental health is important and our emotional health is important. But I think when we hear the term health, we immediately start to fixate on the physical aspect of health. Mm-hmm. And so we say, hey, that's a healthy person. And we're strictly talking about their body. And that's just one small aspect of it. I mean, there's physical, social, psychological, emotional, economic, which you working in WIC, you know how economic health has a dramatic impact on social, physical, emotional, all of those other factors. And so I think it is so important that we bring that up and that we address that when we're talking about nutrition and physical activity, because it's not just about the physical part of our health. There's so much more to it. Pizza and social, that's important. had somebody just yesterday, and he was talking about going out with a friend for a birthday celebration. And I said, I hope you're planning to thoroughly enjoy yourself and eat what you want off of the menu and that you're not going to try and lighten that load. He's like, well, I was kind of looking on the menu and looking, and I said, you don't eat out much, enjoy yourself. And he did. And so I'm glad that he did. But those are the kinds of things that people sort of lose sight of, I think.
Because we're often told that's, Sorry,
mm-hmm.
go on.
No, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, because that's often what we're told, isn't it? It's what we're told we should do. We should plan ahead. We should check the calories on the menu, all of that. And it's like it's become accepted, you know, and it's okay. And like you said, it's not, is it? Because it does affect our social functioning.
Yeah. And you can eat as quote unquote healthy as you want if you're not getting enough sleep at night. Yeah. That's going to affect your health. If your stress is through the roof, that's going to affect your health. Mm. If you're isolated in your house, which we've seen over the last year, the mental health rates, depression and anxiety from people being isolated, how that's been affected. Doesn't matter how healthy they're eating, we need that social interaction. And just like you said, Jeff, with the economic status, some people have these beliefs that you have to eat organic and non-GMO and all these things, where so many people don't have access to that. This stuff's expensive, and you can eat a perfectly good diet. You can listen to your body. You can support your health by, you can probably do your grocery shopping at the dollar store and, you know, get your canned vegetables, your frozen vegetables. Yeah. They don't have, so it's all relative.
That's such a great point. That's one of the things that has really frustrated me as I've gone through my own journey of starting out with, you know, when I got into fitness, it was bodybuilding.com, just to give you an idea. So I've gone from there now to kind of where I really am now, which is I really love this intuitive eating way of approaching things. And so it's been a process for myself and a journey but yeah, that's just such a important factor there. And looking at that at every aspect of our health and that economic thing is, I was starting to lose my train of thought there for a second. The economic part is something that I think that the fitness community especially is overlooking, because they're putting up these meals, and there's nothing wrong with having a wonderful, beautifully cooked meal with fresh vegetables and wild caught salmon and all of these wonderful ingredients that, you know, that we might get at a nice restaurant, or that we might spend $30 or $40 for one meal for two or three of our family members on preparing. But that's not realistic for people who are on WIC, for example, who are actually getting supplemental foods in order to supplement their diet with beans and milk and rice and potatoes and those kinds of things that are important to provide adequate energy and just kind of a bare bones nutritional requirements for those people. And when you start putting out all of these things and almost guilting people, is what I see in the fitness world, guilting people into, well, your diet, you know, you're eating potatoes and chicken, and your chicken is not hormone free, and your potatoes are not organic, and your mac and cheese is boxed. And it's like, that's what they can afford. And yet now they're being guilted into it and almost told that you're not providing adequate nutrition for yourself, which thus means you're not providing adequate nutrition for your children. And it's just such a damaging message, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And by all means, if you have the financial ability to only buy organic, and that's truly the taste that you enjoy, then go for it. But if you're just doing it because you think it's healthier, you could definitely reevaluate that and maybe save a few dollars. But I also see there's so much like around school lunches, people demonizing them, how they are full of whatever, and how like it's not responsible parents to let their kids buy lunch, and so unhealthy and stuff. But there are so many kids that rely on that school lunch or breakfast to just get enough food in their day. And when we make them feel bad for that, they're going to second guess whether they should eat them. And they might even get to an age where they can choose for themselves not to eat them and just totally miss a meal, because they're going to start thinking that is healthier than eating what that school lunch is. And how sad is that? Yeah. Any food is beneficial to our body, and any food is more beneficial than not enough food or no food.
No, I think that's a really, really great point as well. And it's not just about school dinners, you know, that are provided. I think there's also as well, there's this big thing about packed lunches as well. And, you know, there's this, the amount of times, and even my own son has come home and has been like, you know, my teacher said, I'm not allowed to have that in my pack up, mum. Or so-and-so has laughed at me for having such and such in my pack up. And that's affected how my 10-year-old eats. And when did it become okay to make a judgment on somebody? You know, and, you know, when he came home and he said, you know, my teacher said, I'm not allowed this in my pack up. I was like, you know, basically that's telling my son that his mother isn't feeding him well. And, you know, and it's like, it's just mad. It really is.
Yeah. Well, maybe you can talk a little bit about that trust aspect of that division of responsibility that you were talking about earlier and the importance of that, because that's a really important factor when we're dealing with this. And it's so important for really any adult who's interacting with children at any level, where feeding may involve, whether it's as just a parent with children and their friends coming over, if you're an aunt and uncle or a grandparent or a teacher, how does that trust relationship work into that division of responsibility also?
Yeah, great question. And so as we were saying earlier, the job of the child is to choose if they eat and how much they eat. And if you watch newborns, you know, they know when they're hungry and they know when they're full. And so we're all born with that ability. And as we get older, we can hold on to it if the culture around us helps us protect that. But for so, so many of us, it's near impossible, and we lose touch with that. And so that's the first tip, trusting your child to know how much they need to eat. So if they only take two bites, instead of, you know, you need to take two more bites before you leave the table, I would just say, okay, check your tummy, make sure you're full. This is when our next meal or snack is going to be served. If they want five servings, just helping them to trust that and providing that for them, because children grow at rapid rates. They are playing all the time. And so their hunger is going to be different day to day. And then when it comes to the play foods or treat foods, so we were talking about cookies earlier, my first tip would be serving it with the meal. So you put out lunch, you put the cookie on that plate as well, and letting them eat it. You know, they don't have to eat their fruit before they eat their cookie. They can eat the cookie first. And if they ask for another cookie, I would give it and I would keep giving it. Of course, if you don't have enough, that's one thing. But assuming you have enough to keep providing, then trusting those children, because what happens is when you say, no, we're only allowed to have one cookie, but you can have as much of the chicken as you want, then they start learning, well, something special about this cookie that I can only have one of them. So I want more of them. And then they're going to, then we grow up into adults who don't trust ourselves around cookies, who think of cookies as bad foods, as think of cookies as something we have to limit for ourselves. And then before we know it, we do let ourselves have one cookie and then we eat 10 cookies and we're not even enjoying them. We're just eating them. We're kids and we can start from the early age teaching them cookies are always going to be available to you. So you can stop when you're full and we can have cookies with lunch again tomorrow.
Yeah, that's really interesting, actually, because, I mean, my kids are pretty good with that, actually. Like Leo, he knows when enough is enough. And he knows that, yeah, but sometimes I do offer him to have as much as he wants of a certain, you know, play food, let's say. And he very rarely overeats them on occasion. But if he does, he knows afterwards, he's like, oh, I ate too much, mommy. But it's interesting because I probably do portion out their desserts. Like their main meals, yes, they can eat as much as is available. So if they want more bread with their meal, if they want more potatoes, that's fine. If it's available, they can have as much as they want. But I must admit that probably desserts, because sometimes they will be like, well, mommy, can I have biscuits and an ice cream? And I'm like, no, one or the other. Or can I have, I must admit that I probably do portion out their desserts rather than letting them have kind of free reign over it. There are occasions when they do, you know, there are occasions when they can eat whatever they want as much as, but I'd say on a day-to-day basis, I probably do kind of tell them, kind of give them a portion, I suppose, of dessert, and that's what's available and that's it. So you're saying, yeah.
And that's where it comes down to also, remember as the parent, you do decide what is served. So if you decide not to serve dessert that day, that's totally fine. And you just say, cookies aren't on the menu right now. I'll try and remember to put them on the menu tomorrow or next week. I definitely recommend making them a regular part of life because
they probably have dessert after every, it's almost, and sometimes I do think I've, you know, rod for my own back because now they're always, you know, they, desserts are usually anyway, there are times when it's like, no, you know, it's late or, you know, but usually they have access to dessert. And like you said, there's sometimes they can have it before yesterday. They had their cookies before their lunch. It's just the way, you know, so it's not, and we spoke about this before, haven't we, Jeff? And that does work really nicely. My elder, probably not. My eldest is a bit older. And like I said, he prefers to have his lunch and then his dessert, you know, it's kind of the way it is for him. But with my youngest, definitely he would probably, he likes that flexibility. But I think it's this, yeah, if they said to me, mummy, can I have half the packet of biscuits? I don't, you know, it would be like, no, you can have two or three and that's it. So yeah, but maybe it's something to think about. Cause I have sometimes thought to myself, should I let them have as much? Cause I will let them have as much dinner as they want. So should I let them have as much dessert as they want as well? But I don't think I ever have. But what you say makes sense. Yeah.
Totally. Yeah. Because it comes down to why won't you let them have more?
Yeah. Yeah. One thing that Ellen Satter has written about on the topic of desserts is, and this was something when I just first started looking into her work and everything, I was kind of, and I didn't have the full picture yet, but she talks about how with desserts, that it's the one exception to the rule that she uses to the how much part. And that being because it has an unfair advantage for a lot of kids. So, you know, for Luca, it doesn't sound like it really has an unfair advantage. He'll eat, you can give him a whole package of cookies on the table and he won't eat the whole package. And so in that case, then you don't have to worry about it. But for some kids, it would be an unfair advantage, at least initially. And so by serving one serving of dessert for each person, it's not a way of, you're not forcing them to stop eating the amount that they feel is right for them as far as the overall content of the meal. But you're recognizing that dessert does have a bit of an unfair advantage because of the sweet taste of it and that kind of thing. And so a single serving is,
I will say that's one area I disagree with Ellen Satter, because I think it does teach restriction. Like, we shouldn't let ourselves have as many cookies as we want. And it teaches us not to trust our body around those cookies.
Yeah.
And I think that's rooted in diet culture. Why don't we want our children to have all these cookies because of the sugar, because of blah, blah, blah. When instead, if you just watching families that do let their children, you know, it's not that we're letting them go to the pantry on their own and grab box cookies and take them to their room. No, it's at the meal the parent decides. But you'll see kids and they take, when they have this access, they take a bite of the cookie and then they're good. Not always. Sometimes they will eat five and that's fine. The point is, though, we're trusting them to make those decisions and learn to feel safe around them.
Yeah, that's a good point. I think that's a really good point because I think each person's different too. I mean, and I think initially, and that's kind of where we sometimes have to encourage parents, is that when you're making a drastic change from this lack of structure, possibly, or free for all, or very rigid way that you're feeding their children, and now you start using this division of responsibility and start allowing the child to stick to their role and you're sticking to your role, that initially they may eat the whole 10 cookies. If you say you can eat as much as you want, they may do that. But over time, that's probably not going to be where they settle. Because I know for myself, this is a perfect example. Yesterday, my wife wanted donuts. So we went to get donuts. I love donuts, but I was in the mood for a jalapeno cheese bagel. So I got her donuts and I went and got a jalapeno cheese bagel at a different place. And so donuts don't always have an unfair advantage. If I ate donuts all the time, I get tired of them. And I think that's something that a lot of parents don't realize, is that their kids will get tired of the same thing if we are giving them opportunities to enjoy a variety of foods. We're presenting new and unfamiliar foods to them, but allowing them to decide whether they're going to eat it and just giving them the opportunity to explore a variety of different foods. For me, cake does not have an unfair advantage at a meal, but biscuits would, and biscuits by the American biscuits.
Even recently I noticed every time I had pancakes, I was just like so excited and I just wanted to eat so many pancakes. So I started making them for myself more often. And now I have a bag of frozen pancakes in the freezer that I haven't touched in a while because I'm good on them. But I also think it's important to make it clear that our goal is not to make the kids tired of that food.
True.
It's just to help them to know that it's just a neutral food. Yeah.
Let's normalize it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's a great point. And in all honesty, I think I am quite fortunate with my kids, and because, you know, sometimes after dinner they'll want fruit, like today they just wanted strawberries. Sometimes they'll want cookies. And I think it's more around when they say to me, and this is where I probably have restricted, I suppose, but it's been really great to have this conversation. It's when they've said, I want the ice cream and I want the chocolate bar. And it's usually because they can't decide which one they want. And so they're like, I want both, mummy. And I'm like, I can't give them both. You know, I'm like, I can't allow them to just eat all of that in one go. Whereas when I think about it, probably if I turn around and said, well, you know, here, have both, the chances are they probably wouldn't eat all of it anyway. They'd eat a bit of one and a bit of the other. And then the kind of novelty would wear off. Really great. What another thing, and this probably is a bit of a, you know, something I've noticed as well, but I really would love your, because I'm sure a lot of other parents have witnessed this as well. But with my 10-year-old, I'm noticing that he is eating really fast because he wants to leave the table and he wants to go and back on his phone or back with his friends, you know? I mean, we have this rule that we have to all wait till everybody's finished. And it is a bit frustrating because my youngest is the slowest eater on the planet. but I have noticed, like, he'll come to the table and he's hungry, he wants his dinner, but then he eats so fast that he gets full really, really quickly. And I know he's going to be hungrier, you know, than he would be if he'd slowed down and ate his dinner sooner. So yeah, and I don't want to kind of make a big thing of it, but how would you approach that? And is that something that you've come across with some of the families that you're working with? I definitely, like I said, I think it's part of his age and the fact that he just wants to be off from the dinner table as quickly as possible. But, you know, I was just sat there yesterday, I was like, Luke, I noticed anyway, I didn't make a big thing of it, but I just noticed that he ate so fast to get away that he would have been overly full without being full, if that makes sense.
Yeah. And it sounds like you already have it in place where they can't just leave the table when they finish their meal. They do have to wait a certain amount of time, which would be my first suggestion. Yeah. And even if it's a lot of people use a sand timer and you show like you can't leave the table until the sand timer is up. And then it's like no matter how fast he eats, it doesn't really matter because the timer's not up yet. But I think also, and especially for little kids, you know, you can have them in charge of flipping it, in charge of watching it, and being realistic with age. I mean, your child is a little bit older, so he can sit there for a decent amount of time. But for an example of a 2-year-old or a 3-year-old, don't expect them to sit there for 30 minutes, maybe start with 5 minutes. But then I think also it is okay to say, you know, are we chewing our food all the way? And just talking through that and modeling that for them, like asking questions, how does this taste? What's the texture of this? Because that kind of forces them to slow down and think about it.
Yesterday, because it was, I was like, did you even taste those peas, Luca? I put lemon in those peas. He loves lemon. I'm like, did you even oh no, I didn't realize, mom. And I was like, no, because you ate so fast.
Yeah, exactly. And like you said, like how you said, not making a big deal out of it because that is embarrassing. And then
I want to make him feel that he,
because that can become as pressure to slow down. And then if they do slow down, they might feel embarrassed, like someone's going to notice. So kind of just, like I said, talking about it indirectly, saying like, oh, like, do you taste the lemon in the peas? And then that kind of forces him to slow down. And do I taste the lemon in those peas?
Yeah,
that's a good point, because it's really not the speed that we eat that causes these issues down the line. It's these problems where we lose track and lose sight of and lose that connection with our food and with eating. Mm-hmm. So it's not so much the speed, it's that we've lost that connection. And that's the thing that that down the line can be a problem. So if we're one of the things that I love about the approaches that you've been talking about is that you're really going at the root of the issue on anything that you're dealing with. You're not trying to treat symptoms. So rather than how do I get my kid to eat more vegetables? How do I get my kid to slow down? How do I get my kid to not eat so many sweets? Where we're talking about like manipulating that how much part of the equation. Instead, we're saying, how do I help them to enjoy a greater variety of foods?
Yeah.
How do I help them to learn to enjoy different flavors and to pick up on different textures and to enjoy their food more? And then how do I help them to eat the right amount that is appropriate for their unique body? And then what happens is that then their body will shrink or grow or maintain as appropriate, just naturally. So we're not treating, you know, we're not trying to manipulate the scale number. We're not trying to manipulate how much, quote, junk food they're eating and all of those kinds of things. And so rather just getting at the core of it. And so, you know, like you were talking about saying, oh, did you notice the lemon that I put in there? Or asking the question, hey, did you, as he's shoveling the peas in, say, hey, did you notice I did something different with the peas? And then might stop and say, no, what'd you do? You tell me.
I think I did. Yeah. I think it was a bit like that, because it's like, what have you done?
But,
don't worry.
Yeah. But and it kind of makes a little fun game of it too. And I know someone like Luca, who's just, he loves his food. He loves cooking and that whole, I could see him.
Yeah. That's been amazing for my
kid. I could see that actually being kind of a fun thing for him.
Yeah. So
where would you, as we're getting kind of toward the end here, where would you say is the best place for parents to start if they are concerned about their children's eating? Obviously, seeing a specialist would be wonderful for probably anybody. But, you know, apart from that, if someone's just listening and wanting kind of some, you know, some tips for how to approach it with their kids, what would your top tip or top tips be to kind of get the ball rolling?
Yeah. So my first tip, like you said, seeing a specialist, seeing a dietitian or nutritionist like one of you is great if you have access to that. I think so many people, we wait too long. We wait until our child has an eating disorder. And then, you know, you're going to have years of stuff to work through. But if you start now, start when your children are young, you know, you probably don't think you really need to do it, but why not? Start now, work with somebody so that you don't get to the point where you have to work with somebody. But if that's not available to you or you're not ready to make that yet, then I would also recommend first looking into your own food beliefs. You know, read Intuitive Eating for yourself. Read Anti-Diet by Christy Harrison for yourself. Listen to podcasts like this one or like others who have the anti-diet intuitive eating. So working on your own mindset, and for children, implementing that division of responsibility. So in the division of responsibility, the core of it is that we're working to raise competent, intuitive, confident eaters. So again, that's the parents choose where the food is served. So we're looking for a distraction-free place, like a kitchen table, a picnic blanket. They're choosing when the food is served. So instead of waiting for your child to come to you and say you're hungry, you have a schedule that you pretty much, you know, loosely, everything's flexible, keep them on. And that helps them to feel safe. It helps them to trust that food is always coming again so they can focus on other things.
Yeah.
The parent decides what food is served. So you can make sure you're serving a balanced meal. You are implementing treat foods when you decide to, and you're making sure that they are being offered a variety of things for a variety of exposures. And then the last part of the division responsibility is that the child decides if they're going to eat and how much they're going to eat. So implementing that can really, and if your child is older, so you're not doing this from the start, don't just make that shift. I would, you know, of course, be on the same page with your partner if there's two parents in the house. And then talk with your child. Say, we're going to make some changes to how we eat. This is how it's going to work. And then hold your ground, because they're probably going to test you a little bit, and that's okay. But hold your ground on it, and they will. Kids are resilient. They will shift with you.
I involved them. I did involve, because it's not something I started with when I first had children. And it's something that slipped a little bit at the beginning of lockdown, I'm not going to lie. But getting them involved, giving them some responsibility in it as well, in terms of like, this is how we're going to do things now, guys. And like saying, okay, this is the, with Luca, it was about like, this is the time that we're going to have snack, this is the time we're going to have lunch. And with Leo, tying it in with the tasks that we were doing and stuff, it really did, like giving them some involvement in it was really powerful. And, you know, I can say the division response, but, you know, applying that with my children has been incredible. You know, I've seen, I'm not going to say it was easy, because one thing I will say as well is that it's really tested me. And really, like, I love what you said then there about, if you haven't got access to somebody, then, you know, start questioning your own beliefs, start being curious about why you're eating in the way you are and what's driving that. And I think that's so powerful, because, I, you know, definitely having my own children has made me do that. And it's helped me in my recovery. It's helped me heal. And it's helped us have a much deeper, stronger relationship.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah.
Well, this has been a wonderful conversation. I've really, really enjoyed this. And we definitely need to have you back on again at some point to talk about
questions I've got to ask you as well.
I know. we could do 3 hours of this very easily.
Yeah. This has been so fun. Anytime.
Great. I love hearing that. So tell us, though, how you, people can get in contact with you? What's the best way to follow you? I do definitely give the Instagram link, and definitely anybody listening, follow her there. She provides these wonderful little, very quick little, what are they, reels on Instagram, kind of your TikTok-y type things, but the real quick, simple, you don't have to sit there and listen to a long video, and they're so, so practical. And so I highly, highly encourage you to follow her on Instagram. But oh, yeah, go ahead and tell us how they can find you.
I never thought I would be into reels or TikToks, but you make one and they're so fun. So you keep making them. So on Instagram, I am at Morgan Skatz, RDN. So Morgan, SKATZ, RDN. And on Facebook, I am Morgan Skatz, RDN. I also have a blog that the link to my blog is can be easily found through my Instagram and my Facebook page. I haven't written a lot of blog posts recently because I kind of just write whenever I feel like there's a topic to write about that I want to share. So it's very intermittent, but there's some old ones. When I first made it, I had so much I wanted to get out. So there's definitely some old ones to go through.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And we'll make sure they include links to those in the show notes also.
Thank you. And I will say the private practice I work at is Mid-Atlantic Nutrition Specialist. So you can also look up their website and find more information about me there and the whole practice as well.
Yeah. And now you said that's in Lancaster.
It is in Lancaster, Pennsylvania. Yeah. We work in person and virtually as well. Good.
Okay. That's excellent to know. So if you happen to live in that area and need a dietitian, you know who to go to. And since they work virtually, you can get in contact with them that way also. So that is fantastic. Well, thank you again for joining us, and look forward to having you on again, and hope you have a wonderful rest of your weekend.
Thank you so much.
I really enjoyed this. Thank you.
Thank you.